This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the big summer movies Ant-Man, Trainwreck, Mr. Holmes, which is a smaller one, and then something from television, Sharknado 3. I've actually got an advanced look at that before it airs on Wednesday night. I also have a listener recommendation that I'm going to finally respond to because I haven't had time to. In addition to that, I've got the news, the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. And I also have to give a big shout-out to some new affiliates that we've picked up. News Talk 1180 WJNT in Jackson, Mississippi is now airing Fat Guys at the Movies Sundays at 7 a.m. And AM 1270 WTSN in Dover, New Hampshire is also airing Fat Guys at the Movies on Sundays at 1 p.m. Thank you so much, and welcome to the Fat Guys Network. The revolution will not be televised. It will be on the radio, and you can listen to me here on your local station. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the interwebs at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, as well as Instagram with fatguysatthemovies. And you can also check me out on Twitter at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. I'm going to talk a little bit about mostly Comic-Con news. It's not all Comic-Con news, and I know Comic-Con was last weekend, but things are developing throughout the weekend. The big stuff pushes into the weekend, well past the airing of the show. Actually, one thing that didn't come out of Comic-Con, the new images for the female Ghostbusters, directed by Paul Feig, came out. And the images are, they're just costumes. They're the costumes that they wear, which is an update of the original costumes from the movie from 1984. And they have the Ecto-Mobile, the car they drive, which again looks like an updated version of that retrofitted ambulance. They look fine to me. I mean, it's a costume. It's a car. That doesn't exactly jazz me up to see a movie one way or the other. What I find amazing is the knee-jerk reverse sexism that's being thrown around. And of course, the internet is all about being offended and pointing fingers and calling people names and saying how you are demeaning one group or another. What I find interesting, and this is going to dovetail into my review of Trainwreck, actually, is when people have taken issue with anything about this new version of the Ghostbusters that's got the quote-unquote all-female cast, which it doesn't. It's just a role reversal cast because Chris Hemsworth is playing the Annie Potts character from the first one. So it's not all women. It's just they have the women as the Ghostbusters. People are immediately saying, well, it's because you hate women. What, are you scared of women? Are you intimidated by women? First of all, I don't like the idea of just stunt casting. To me, stunt casting is in general kind of boring. It just seems like they said, we're going to make a Ghostbusters, but we're going to make it all females. That's going to be the catch. And it may suck for all we know. It blows my mind that now we've gotten to the point that you can't even criticize something with cogent and realistic criticisms because you're suddenly branded, oh, you hate women. Keep that in mind later on when I review Trainwreck coming up soon. Now into the Comic-Con news. The big winners in Comic-Con this year were Warner Brothers for the Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice presentation and the Suicide Squad presentation. They did a presentation for Pan, but I didn't hear anyone even care about that. Also, Star Wars, Disney, and Lucasfilm is a big winner because they had a big Star Wars panel. What's interesting is what Star Wars did was it didn't release a trailer. It released behind-the-scenes footage, which I haven't watched because I don't like to see too much spoilers. That stuff can be very spoilery to me. But it really endeared its audience, which is cool. It wasn't like unique footage. It was all behind-the-scenes stuff, which gave them something exclusive to watch and something new to watch in Hall H. But it wasn't revealing the story and the characters as widespread as a trailer would. But the best news that has come out of Comic-Con this year, in my opinion, is the fact that Ben Affleck is going to write and direct the solo Batman movie that should follow up Dawn of Justice. And I think that's fantastic because I think Ben Affleck is a fantastic director. I think he's a good writer too. Most people have all, he's still shackled by people saying, hey, it's Ben Affleck. He's just a stupid actor. The guy's he's a good writer and he's a good director. He hasn't just won an Oscar. He's won a couple Oscars and he should have gotten best director for Argo, but he wasn't nominated. couple other little things in Comic-Con. These are, it's not even news, because most of the news is just rumors sometimes and just official release dates. I did find it interesting. A whole bunch of buzz came out for the Deadpool movie, which, of course, everybody's going crazy because they love Deadpool and love the character. And yeah, they showed a trailer and that leaked online as well. I'm kind of avoiding that because I know that's going to come out in February, so I'll see it then. But what I find fascinating is it made news was Ryan Reynolds came out and during the panel and he apparently bashed the Green Lantern movie. And this is a pet peeve I have. When somebody comes out and they bash something that they were in that's popularly bashed, like Ryan Reynolds doing Green Lantern and then coming out, well, that was really stupid. Well, you know what? No, you don't get to say that because you were part of it. And yeah, you weren't the director and you didn't make the final decisions, but you were totally on board. And if that movie had done really, really well, you'd be standing behind it. Quit being a Fairweather fan here. Again, same thing with Deadpool. He played Deadpool before in X-Men Origins Wolverine, and of course it was reviled and nobody liked it. They kept the actor and are retooling the character, but you can't say that Ryan Reynolds is perfect for Deadpool because he played Deadpool before and it wasn't what a lot of people liked as a Deadpool character. And then finally, the big thing, we're going to play some trailers here in a minute for the trailer park, but some of the trailers and some of the exclusive footage leaked online out of Hall H, and that put the studios in a tizzy because they were upset that stuff got leaked. Here's the thing that happened. You have Hall H, which is enormous. It is a massive, massive hall. Thousands of people are in this thing. And people have to wait in line, like sleep overnight to get in there. There is no way you will ever stop footage from leaking out of Hall H. With the exception of scanning everybody and bagging and tagging their phones as they come in, like you would at like a press screening. There's no way to do it because they can't go run and put it in their car. And plus, you'd have to process thousands of people. It would take all day to process that. The bottom line is, if you show something in any public setting, anywhere, just assume it's going to get filmed. Now, it's one thing to get mad, like when the Batman versus Superman trailer leaked initially and it came from some Portuguese website and like the Avengers trailer earlier this year leaked before it was revealed. Yeah, that's annoying because that's sometimes an internal thing that you should be able to control. But if you do a public exhibition to thousands and thousands of people, someone's going to pull out a cell phone and get a crappy version of it. So you should do what Star Wars did is they showed their footage and then they immediately released it online. Yes, it's not exclusive to the people at Comic-Con. So, again, I think this goes back to studios don't understand how the internet works. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the trailer park. The first one is the Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice full trailer opens March 25th.
This Bat Vigilante is like a one-man reign of terror. You don't get to decide what the right thing is. Nobody cares about Clark Kent taking on the Batman.
20 years in Gotham, how many good guys are left? How many stayed that way? He has the power to wipe out the entire human race. And we have to destroy him.
I feel better about this than I did the first trailer because it doesn't seem as filled with all the stuff that kind of made Man of Steel eh. And yeah, when Batman's there, that's cool. I still am not sold on Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. She does not look like she can kick anybody's butt. I'm sorry, and that's what Wonder Woman's supposed to look like. The other big DC movie that is coming out is Suicide Squad, and they got a trailer. This is one that actually leaked online and which forced Warner's hand to release it.
It's taking some work, but I finally have them.
The worst of the worst. I want to assemble a task force of the most dangerous people on the planet who I think can do some good.
They're bad guys.
Exactly. And if anything goes wrong, we blame them. We have built-in deniability.
I'm just gonna hurt you. Really, really bad.
This opens on August 5th of next year, not this August 5th. You gotta wait a whole year for this. It looks interesting, and I think that Jared Leto's doing an interesting thing with the Joker. There still needs to be more. This is a very flashy, very high concept trailer. I still think there's going to be problems with it, starting with the fact that David Ayers doesn't put any sort of lightheartedness anywhere close to his movies. And this is such a grim group of characters that are villains that you're supposed to root for and then are going to become villains in other movies. And that's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Mr. Holmes and Sharknado 3. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr rolling back at you, and we're going to be talking about some movies to review right now. We're going to slow things down and talk about something very British, very posh. Bill Condon directed this one. I don't know why I am making fun of Bill Condon. He's like a great director. Directed stuff like Dreamgirls and Kinsey. See, I think he directed the last two Twilight movies, too. What's funny about that is when they were marketing Mr. Holmes, there is nary a mention of Twilight anywhere in the marketing. And you wonder why. Anyways, Mr. Holmes, at 93, Sherlock Holmes is losing his memory and with the help of his housekeeper's son, revisits the final case he took before he left his job as a private detective.
His name is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Did you do the thing?
What thing?
The cane shows the marks of a dog's teeth. The wood is from an island southwest of Madeira. That thing.
That was an embellishment of Dr. Watson. If I ever write a story myself, it will be to correct the myriad misconceptions created by his imaginative license.
I didn't know you wrote stories.
I decided to get it right before I die.
Sherlock Holmes has had more screen versions of him with greater diversity than Batman. You go back to the original older films from the 30s, Basil Rathbone, and that was very true to the books as much as they could be. And the books were just Pulp Fiction stuff back in the day. That's why Sir Arthur Conan Doyle kept trying to kill Sherlock Holmes. He hated the fact he became famous for writing pulp. Over the years, especially recently, there's been several versions of Sherlock Holmes. Three very notable ones. First of all, you had the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies that Guy Ritchie directed. My mom, who's a big fan of Sherlock Holmes, did not like those. She thought they were too punchy and too goofy and a little bit too hip and cool for the more reserved Sherlock Holmes. You also have Sherlock, which is the BBC show, starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman as Watson. That's a fantastic series. There's only like six episodes of it, or nine episodes, because the BBC takes so freaking long to make a series of television. It's been on for like several years, and they're finally getting around to doing their Christmas special, which is going to take place in Victorian London. And then, of course, there's Elementary, which is on CBS, and that's got Lucy Liu as Watson and Johnny Lee Miller as Sherlock Holmes. So there's a bunch of different versions. This falls more in line with the actual Arthur Conan Doyle books. Ian McKellen plays Sherlock Holmes. He's, like I said in the description, he's near the end of his life. He's quite old. He's losing his memory, and he's trying to remember his last case. And he's trying to recall it, and he's trying to write it himself. It's much more of a discovery for Holmes more than it is a mystery. I mean, there is, I guess, a certain mystery as to what the full story was and what the resolution of that case was, which was not what was put into a story format by Watson. It's a character study of an old man coming to terms with the end of his life and his relationship with a kid whose mom works for him, trying to get his legacy to live on a little bit, and sometimes reluctantly, through this kid who's a big fan of the Sherlock Holmes stuff. It's not a mystery, so to speak. It's not a whodunit, even though there's a bit of a mystery. But you can take that all out, and you actually still have a lot more story left. So it's very British. It's very deliberate. It's very drawn out at times. But it's a well-done movie. It's a slow burn. It's not always something I'm going to stampede towards, but it's very much that masterpiece theater without the mystery element to it. Because even then, the mystery is the skullduggery in this is not very skullduggerish. Is that a word? Anyways, I'm still going to say for the acting, because Ian McKellen's fantastic in it. Laura Linney's in it, too. I'm not a big fan of Laura Linney. Ask anybody who knows me. I don't like her. She annoys me. I've never liked her. Like, going back to Congo, I didn't like her in Congo, let alone the, like, more revered stuff she did. So when people say, well, how's Laura Linney? I'm like, she's Laura Linney. The little kid who plays her son, he's really good. So that's the really the reason to see it, is for the acting and the performances. Ian McKellen's fantastic in it, as he is in almost anything he does. And I'm going to have to say, in the end, that Mr. Holmes kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Sharknado 3. Oh, hell no. That's literally the name of the movie. I remember when the first Sharknado came out, it was kind of this pop culture sensation. And then they had a naming contest for the second one. And I submitted Sharknados. And I said it should have taken place in Mexico. You know, DOS, D-O-S. And that would be the two. And they called it Sharknado the next one, which is stupid. I haven't actually seen that one completely through. I started watching it with my kids, but it was so bad, I turned it off and had to go to bed. But in this one, more violent and bloody weather is on its way as a string of Sharknados bear down on the East Coast.
I know how this is going to sound, but I can sense these storms now. These sharks, they have a scent. It's not a pretty one.
Sharknados have now been reported all up and down the East Coast.
They're everywhere.
Is this going to be the big one? Is this going to be one we can't contain?
Emerging Sharknados?
Shark again.
Oh, hell no!
Millions of people are going to die.
This is not going to be in your theaters until Riff Tracks, of course, does their own version of it, which should be out sometime next year. This is on the Sci-Fi Channel. It premieres on Wednesday, the 22nd, at 9 p.m. Eastern. I got an opportunity to see it early. They actually sent me this really cool kit. You can go check my Instagram. My Instagram handle is Fat Guys at the Movies. You can see all the cool stuff they sent me. They sent me candy. You send me food, and I will talk about your movie. That is how easily I am bought in this world. They had a map of the coast where all the Sharknados are going to hit. We got a really neat cooler. We got socks and a keychain and like a baby on board little placard for the card that said chainsaw on board in case of emergency. So Sharknado 3, here's the thing that's fascinating about Sharknado 3. Not just the number of, but the actual people doing the cameos is mind-boggling. I'm not even going to say who some of these cameos are, because my jaw hit the floor when these people showed up. I mean, like some of them, like Holly Madison and Kendra Wilkinson, the girls next door, Hugh Hefner's former squeezes, they're in the movie in bit parts. They're not surprising to be in the movie because you expect these reality show tramps to be on those. But the people that showed up in the movie in key playing positions beats the heck out of Al Roker and Matt Lauer, who showed up, I believe, in the second movie as well. So the cameos are almost worth seeing just for, you just want to know what happened in the back room to get there. It's a ridiculous movie, but it's gotten to the point that it's, you know, it's not even a parody of itself because it is beyond a parody of itself. It is a ludicrous, bonkers movie that has a lot of stuff happening in it. And there's a couple scenes where they have slower dialogue because that's what happened in the first one. It was really low budget. They didn't know it was going to become this weird sensation. There were a lot of boring scenes where people were talking and going from here to there, and there the Sharknado moments were pretty scarce. In Sharknado 3, there is a nonstop poop storm of sharks falling out of the sky in the most amazing situations you're going to see. It is worth tuning in and hopping up on Twitter and live tweeting it with the rest of the country, again, for the cameos and for the ridiculously stupid action and the fact that it moves really fast. And Tara Reid has a robot hand. So suck it, Douglas Reynolds. That's an IT Crowd joke. For those who don't know. So you got Douglas Reynolds from the IT Crowd, Tara Reid, and Darth Vader. Those are the three most famous robot hands in the country. Anyways, I have to say, for sheer enjoyment, Sharknado 3 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Well, it's time for me to go to a break. I mean, how do we follow up Sharknado 3? This is how we do it with Ant-Man. That's what we're going to be talking about. Ant-Man and Trainwreck on the other side of the break.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk about the big films that are hitting this weekend. Let's talk about Marvel. Ant-Man. A burglar is given a chance to redeem himself for good with a superhero suit that allows him to shrink down to microscopic proportions.
If you give godlike powers to everyone, it's going to be chaos.
So how do we stop him?
I know a guy. I've been watching you for a while. You're different. And I believe everyone deserves a shot at redemption. Do you?
Absolutely. My days of breaking into places and stealing stuff are over. What do you want me to do?
I want you to break into a place and steal some stuff.
Makes sense.
The last Marvel movie from Marvel Studios, owned by Disney, that came out was Avengers Age of Ultron, and I was a little disappointed at that. And the reason was is because, I mean, it was such a huge movie, and it had so many characters to it. It just had to play to all the different characters in all the different movies and have references here and there and this and that and the other thing. Then they had to set up stuff for all these other movies that are coming up. It kind of started to collapse under its own weight. It didn't have the streamlined coolness of the first Avengers. It had the feel of a movie that had so many things tacked onto it that it was like the proverbial camel with all the straws on its back before it finally collapses. This is a much cleaner film. And it goes back to the spirit of the original pre-Avengers Marvel movies, stuff like Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, the First Avenger, and The Incredible Hulk, where it's just kind of a standalone movie, and it's about one person, and it's about one character, so you can take the time to focus on that person and his story. It's not groundbreaking. It can be very predictable at times, and the characters aren't terribly different than what you've seen before, but it all works. Paul Rudd makes a great character, because Ant-Man's a little bit sarcastic. He's not this diehard justice junkie. I mean, he's a burglar. And you've got Michael Douglas playing Hank Pym, who's the guy who creates the Ant-Man outfit. And they play to a little bit of the history of the comics, and they also tie in a couple things mentioning some Avenger things that work. And ultimately, it's a heist movie. It's about him trying to go into this lab to stop something from being developed. It's a more intimate, it's a smaller story. It's not trying to be the biggest thing ever. And it's also, unlike after seeing all the stuff coming from DC right now, with Superman versus Batman and the Suicide Squad, it's nice to see Ant-Man. That's just kind of good summer fun. And I'll tell you, it's hilarious at times. Not in a bad way. I mean, I'm not a big fan of movies that just have to have goofy moments just to be goofy. I mean, we're not going back to the days of Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, or even Catwoman from 10 years ago. We're going back to the days of Iron Man. We're going back to the thing where the characters have some very funny moments that are completely organically felt within the story. There's sometimes some absurd things happen, but you're dealing with a guy who can shrink down to the size of an ant. Go with it, man. The cast is great. Evangeline Lilly is good, and she gets teased that she's going to maybe have a bigger role later on. It also brings back the post-credit sequences, so don't leave when it's over. We learned that from many Marvel movies, and then Joss Whedon had to go not do it in Avengers. But, yep, there's still stuff. Stay to the end. I liked Ant-Man. I thought it was a hoot. It was a blast. It was a lot of fun. And my kids went with me. They loved it, too. It's one of my favorite intro to a character movies out there in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So I'm going to have to say Ant-Man rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Trainwreck. Comedian Amy Schumer plays a version of her stage persona, a woman who refuses to commit to a relationship and parties way too hard, finding herself falling in love with the down-to-earth sports medicine doctor.
Hold on, I was drunk last night, now it's all kicking in, and I don't feel right.
I'm just a modern chick who does what she wants. Before you judge, you should know I'm doing fine. My friends are awesome, my apartment's sick, and I have a great job at a men's magazine.
What am I doing? I slept at the doctor's place last night.
My boy got intimate.
Yes.
Sexual intercourse.
Oh!
You never spend the night. What were you, blackout drunk?
No, I had like 2 drinks. 3 max. 4 now that I'm tallying.
I've never watched Amy Schumer's stand-up. I've never watched her show. That she's got a show on Comedy Central. I'm aware of her because so many people talk about her. but I don't watch her stuff. And I'm sure her stage show is very funny. She's a very funny girl, and she definitely has presence. She definitely has a personality that works on screen. She's very approachable. One of the hardest things about being a comedian, and this kind of works into Trainwreck, is most comedians are very depressing people. They're generally not happy people. And that's because to get the comedy, you have to suffer and you have to deal with crap in your life. If you really want to know what a comedian's like, the best representation of a real life comedian is watching the show Louis on FX. He's a depressing person who can barely function because of his own hangups. And there's a movie that came out, a really pretty good movie, a couple weeks ago. I talked about it, called Misery Loves Comedy. And it's a documentary about comedians and how they deal with misery in their life and how they turn it into material for the stage. And I've known several comedians. I've had friends that are comedians. And while I enjoy hanging out with them, they're depressing people. They're not a happy bunch. As a result, the extreme character that Amy Schumer plays is she's a horrible person. It has some funny moments. It has some laugh out loud moments, but it's ultimately just a gender swap. She plays the Owen Wilson character, the guy who just runs around, can't commit, and has sex with everybody. And then he meets somebody who's really nice and cool and down to earth, falls in love with her, and she softens him up. It just reverses the role. I mean, to the point of absurdity where they have Bill Hader, who plays her love interest, who, I mean, as great as Bill Hader is, he's brilliant, and he's a very funny guy. He's not given much to do in this movie. He's really just the blank love interest. His best friend is played by LeBron James, plain LeBron James. And actually, James does a really good job in the movie in front of the camera. You know, sometimes you put an athlete in front of the camera and you don't know how they're going to respond to a script. He does a good job. He's very funny. But he basically plays the best friend who's worried, oh, don't make my BFF cry. And Amy Schumer's character has a friend who's an equally loose, drunken woman who is playing her basketball buddy, you know, the equivalent of the basketball buddy in what would be an Owen Wilson movie. My problem is, if they're not people I'd want to hang out with, I generally don't like movies about people. The only time I like movies about horrible people, I use the show It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and The League. These are all horrible people you would never want to spend any time with or be friends with or let them in your home, but it's funny to watch things happen to them. The problem with this is we're supposed to be on her character's side. And I never was because, well, she's, and this is what's going to get me in trouble because people are going to be like, oh, you hate women. Going back to the Ghostbusters thing. She's a slut. I mean, she is a raging whore. And I don't care who I offend with saying that because she's like every night going out and getting plastered drunk and going home with anybody. And then making a point not to stay over, not wanting to get in any relationship. Now, for the record, I don't like that as a behavior of a character, whether they're male or female. And she is a raging alcoholic. And there's like no redemption for that. I mean, there's a turnaround and you see change in the characters, but it so minimizes what a raging alcoholic she is. And it minimizes what alcoholism really is. And it's because it's so central there. It's not just that she goes on parties too much. She drinks to survive in this movie. And that's what I find unpleasant. And I was thinking about this and I'm like, well, you know, cause I'm like, okay, let me deal with this criticism I'm going to get. Cause people are going to say, oh, you don't like hearing a woman talk about sex. Well, okay. First of all, in 2015, a woman talking about sex brazenly is not new. Go back to Joan Rivers back in the 60s. That was edgy. Heck, go back 5 years ago with Sarah Silverman. Go back to when Jenny McCarthy was farting in live broadcasts of MTV back in the 90s. There is nothing bold and daring about what Amy Schumer's doing because it's been done a lot by a lot of people. So she's not really breaking ground here. But I remember when I watched a lot of stand-up comedy back in the 90s when I was in college, I never liked the comedy that revolved around, so I was out and I was having sex with this girl, and that's all the comedy was. I never found that interesting. You know who's one of the best comic in America right now? Jim Gaffigan. Jim Gaffigan's brilliantly funny because he doesn't go for the cheap joke. He works around it. He works harder to not really swear or talk too much about sex because it's so easy to do that. I don't have a problem with Amy Schumer. I'm sure she's probably a very nice person. I just wasn't a big fan of the characters in this movie, and that's why I didn't like it. So I'm going to have to say Trainwreck kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for me this segment. Let's go hear some commercials, and then I'll come back and talk about a listener recommendation, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup.
Shake that.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
And we're back with Fat Guys at the Movies. Kevin Carr, your fearless leader, heading into the movie review dynasty. Earlier this year, I started listener recommendations, and I've only done a handful of them because I've been reviewing so many films. And if I get a recommendation, I want to take the time to talk about that movie. This week, I've got a lower number of movies to talk about, so I'm going to be taking up a listener recommendation this week. This comes from longtime listener Red State Gabe, and it is Torch Song Trilogy. Came out in 1988, written by Harvey Fierstein, also starring Harvey Fierstein, partly autobiographical in some ways. And it is based on his Tony Award-winning play about a gay man in a drag queen show in New York City, dealing with a series of romances as well as dealing with his family.
Can you use a couple of bucks, Arnold? Just till you're on your feet.
I'm on my feet, Daddy.
Yeah, in 6-inch heels.
You go to see the beautiful dames.
With a voice and a face like this, I got nothing to worry about. I can always drive a cab.
If I had ever opened a mouth to my mother the way you did to me, you'd be talking to a woman with a size 6 wedgie sticking out of her forehead.
I think that I prefer you in men's clothes.
Yes!
You might meet a nice girl someday. You never know.
Believe me, Ma. I know.
I never saw this when it first came out. I kind of swerved into a showing of this. I used to work at when I was in college, I was in a film club where we showed films on campus. And we showed this once. And it was only a couple years old. It was only like 5 or 6 years old when we showed it. But I remember being back in the booth. I took tickets. I took the money from the students who were going in to see it. And I remember wandering in and seeing part of the movie. But I never sat down and watched it until just now. So I'd never seen it before. Now everyone knows who Harvey Fierstein is. They've seen him in Independence Day. They've seen him in Mrs. Doubtfire. He's sort of this bigger-than-life figure with his voice that talks like this. And this is before that. And it's so funny because even though in the early 90s and mid-90s, he galvanized himself in the public eye in Mrs. Doubtfire and in Independence Day, two very high-profile roles, he looks very different in this movie. And again, this is like 8 years before he did Independence Day. So it's not like it was decades. He was much thinner. He was much younger. And he looks a very young, good-looking man in this movie. Thin. And it's made at a time. It made in the 80s. And it was, he did the stage show earlier, and then they made the movie out of it. Won a Tony Award. And it's about the life of a gay man in New York City in the 70s, and it takes place over 3 sections. Torch Song is a love song. His drag queen persona sings love songs, and it's the 3 sections of his life and the relationships he had. And what's kind of groundbreaking about it, it's not that there weren't gay movies out before that, because, go rent the Celluloid Closet. You'll see about plenty of gay movies going back decades. But this was a very intimate portrayal, but it wasn't a very sexual movie. I mean, it doesn't stray away from the concepts, but it's much more of just about his life. And it's very funny at times. It's a very funny movie at times, but it also can be heartbreaking. There are some things that happen in this film that, regardless of whether you're gay or straight, it's the kind of things that should touch you emotionally. And everyone should have the same reaction to certain things that happen in this movie, just to him as a person. And it's a very humanizing portrayal, which was great, because you didn't always get that, especially in the late 80s. This showed him as a regular person, and that's a good thing. And it also shows, and more importantly, there's really kind of 2 aspects to it. It's how he deals with his lovers and his relationships, and also how he deals with his family. Anne Bancroft plays his mother. And she plays the very stereotypical nagging, overbearing Jewish mother. And it's kind of a stock role, and it's a role you've seen before, but this is, I think, where he's drawing from his life. And look, I know that there's some people out there who have issues with homosexuality, and this is worth watching because it puts you in the character's shoes, and it puts you in the character's shoes to see what it's like to deal with a family. And it's not a coming out movie. He came out a long time ago, but it's dealing with all the residual effects and the stress within the family where this has never really been an issue that's been put to bed in his life. And that's where it's heartbreaking, because it shows, I don't know if this is typical, I've not gone through this, but I would imagine it's not unheard of. And I have gay friends who've told me that they've had some really horrible experiences dealing with their family when they were coming out. And that's what's interesting about this movie, because it shows you from a very realistic, down-to-earth, non-sexualized standpoint of the clash between the traditional family that thinks this is terrible, horrible, and wrong, and a person that this is the way he is, and he wants to live his life, and all he wants is people just respect him and accept him as their son, and how that doesn't always happen. And it's very powerful, and it's worth seeing, and it's got a lot to say even, you know, gosh, almost 30 years after the movie was made. It still has a lot to say. You know, so sort of like The Birdcage, if you've seen The Birdcage, which I watched a couple months ago for the first time, I'd never seen it. It's worth seeing because regardless of where you're coming from, your point of view and your worldview and your opinion, it humanizes the situation. And in this age of social media and liking and sharing and negative comments and crazy happenings online and people getting offended at everything, we need things to get more humanized. And this is a great way to do it. So yeah, this is a fantastic movie. I'm going to have to say Torch Song Trilogy totally rocks. Thanks, Red State Gabe, for the recommendation.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I have been in a habit this year of completely underestimating the winners of the box office. I said last week that Minions was going to make $85 million. It blew that away. It made $116 million, which is not obviously the biggest weekend of the year at all, because, of course, that was Jurassic Park. And that's almost what Jurassic Park made in its second weekend. But it's still a monumental amount, considering that last year, in 2014, the only movie that made over $100 million its opening weekend, well, I think Hunger Games may have, but was Transformers Age of Extinction, and that was kind of, they fudged the numbers just to get to $100 million so they could get that title. Minions did fantastic. It did phenomenal. Universal is on a run with this and Furious 7 and Jurassic World. There was a time 5 years ago, Universal couldn't even release a movie. The biggest movie of the year in like 2010 or 2011 was Couples Retreat. They made gross less money the entire year than Jurassic World has made up to this point. Just one movie. And they've got a whole bunch of these massive hits. The Gallows came in fifth with just under $10 million, which isn't very good. I mean, it's probably good enough to put this movie in the black because it was a cheap movie to make. But these found footage horror movies aren't getting the huge profit margins they used to get. Then Selfless really tanked. It came in at less than $5.5 million, which is not very good, considering this is the new Deadpool. This is what a lot of people are now looking at this saying, well, yeah, Deadpool might be fun, but Ryan Reynolds, he's not selling movies. Nobody sees a movie for Ryan Reynolds anymore, or ever. And then everything else, Jurassic World. Jurassic World's made by now $600 million. It's pushing up to Avengers. It should probably pass the Avengers, the first one, in terms of domestic box office. This week, I think Ant-Man's going to win. It's going to have a little bit of a fight with Minions, because if Minions holds well, it might end up being a horse race between the two. I think Ant-Man's going to do better than anticipated. It's getting some soft reviews, but those reviews are coming from critics who are grumpy and are just tired of the Marvel formula. I think the mainstream audience is still cool with this stuff. So I think they're going to have a lot of fun and see the movie. $65 million is my prediction for Ant-Man. And then I think actually Trainwreck, I don't know if Trainwreck's going to do well. I mean, she's very popular, but she is the only name. She and LeBron James are the only names that are really out there to sell this movie. So this will be a good test to see how deep the penetration is of Amy Schumer in the marketplace. Yeah, I did that on purpose. You're You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now it's time for the world famous DVD roundup. There are some really good movies out on DVD this week. In particular, It Follows, one of the best horror movies in a while, the best horror movie of the year so far, a great throwback to John Carpenter level horror. It's a fantastic movie. It's creepy as all get out. Lots of fun. Brilliantly done. Ex Machina is also out. That is a really cool sci-fi movie. It has its problems. It does turn in on itself a little bit too much, but it's about artificial intelligence and a guy building a robot. It's a fascinating look at what could happen with artificial intelligence. In the middle, you've got the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, which is okay. It's charming enough. Richard Gere's in it, and he's not as good as the rest of the cast, these old British people. So when he's in the movie, it's kind of stupid. But outside of his character, the rest of the movie's really good. And if you liked the first exotic Marigold Hotel, you'll like this one. And then we're into the bad, which is Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2, which is not good. I actually thought the first one was kind of cute. This one's terrible. It's an excuse sequel. But it's not as bad as the last one I'm going to talk about. The Longest Ride, starring Clint Eastwood's son in a Nicholas Sparks movie about a bull rider finding love. Oh dear, it's bad. Women are going to weep. Men are going to sigh. And I will never watch that movie again. I need to go. My time is up. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Pixels and Southpaw. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.